Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I love this bit. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So, what are we going to cover in this session? What I want to do in this session is look at fairly my first perspectives on 2012 as the server product, and then I'm going to drill into three areas fairly deeply. These are areas which have challenged people for a long time, and I want to show you how 2012 has solved those. Now, even if you're not thinking about deploying those particular sort of technologies now, what I think you'll see is how the product has solved a lot of problems along the way. And as I use it and show you the demos, you should see there's some very, very significant changes in 2012. How many of you have deployed 2012 in a test environment? That's pretty good. That's probably just under a third of the audience. How many of you got it in production? What? Not one hand? Oh, there's one hand up there. I don't know where you're just waving, but... Okay, so let's get kicked in. So there are absolutely hundreds of new changes, and those new changes, you could all argue, are hot changes. I just love the fact that you can now clone domain controllers. So you can take a virtual image of the domain controller and just clone it. How many of you have done install from media previously? If you're building a domain, you use install from media. Anyone done that? Okay, so it's just probably about 20, maybe 30 hands went up. What could be better than a piece of domain controller media than a domain controller itself? It's already got everything on it. And the fact you can just clone it is fantastic. Virtualization protection for domain controllers. That, again, means if we go back to a snapshot, we can just fire the domain controller up again, and it says, hey, I've changed in time. What I better do is an authoritative restore. So it thinks it's just been brought back from backup and goes into authoritative restore mode. That in itself is an interesting challenge. If you've got a proof of concept environment, or you have a demo environment, and you have multiple domain controllers, the way you handle that was normally just have a snapshot, fire them up, you do your testing, and then just revert them back to snapshot. Now when you fire them up, they all come up and say, I'm non-authoritative. Anyone experienced that yet? AD replication works beautifully, but if you're in that situation, sysfol is non-authoritative. All right, so what you need to do then is trigger one of those sysfols to think it's authoritative, and everything works beautifully. So if you are using it in that sort of environment, obviously in production environment, it doesn't matter, but if you're using it in a POC environment where you want to roll back, or you're running it in a test environment, just be aware of that, and you will need to authoritatively restore sysfol on one domain controller. But, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Windows NIC teaming always been a huge challenge, and we've had to deal with that. The changes in performance are dramatic, and particularly around the virtualization changes in performance. PowerShell, how many of you have been attending PowerShell sessions? Okay, I would recommend everyone gets to grips with PowerShell with 2012. It's really, really important for management. So I'm not going to go through all of that lot. What I'm going to concentrate on is, first of all, my first perspective of 2012, and then what I want to do is concentrate on these particular technologies. Okay, so my first dilemma was, do I put in core or do I go for the full OS? This, by the way, is the default installation now. So it defaults to core. So if you don't read, you know that little installation thing comes up and you don't read it because you just click OK, which most of us do all the time. It's just OK, OK, OK. You never read anything. You will end up with a server core. So I had to decide whether to go for server core or whether to go for the full Apple. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. So should I be a man or a mouse? I went for the GUI. But the good thing is it's really easy to switch now. So you can have server core. You can have minimal server interface, you can have GUI, and you can have the full desktop experience. And it's sort of IT pro party thing, isn't it? We went for server core because it gave us the best security posture and minimized updates. And you can see someone else saying, yeah, we actually went for the minimal interface because we want a security posture, we want minimal updates, and also we haven't got all our admins trained up yet, so we still want a little bit of GUI. And then you can see the people, no eye contact at all. They're looking down, and they're shuffling their feet, and you know they went for the desktop experience. But, as I say, GUI, if you've got the GUI, you can just switch between the two, all right? If you do it in PowerShell, again, you can switch between the two. It's a bit difficult in terms of if you're in the GUI, actually, unless you remotely manage it using the GUI. But, of course, you can remotely manage all your cores as well now with a GUI. PowerShell, it's got to become your new best friend, all right? There's IntelliSense in PowerShell. So as you're using PowerShell, notice my command line is install. IntelliSense has dropped down and giving me the options of that's available. Also, help now is very comprehensive. It's also available on the internet, so it's the latest help available. If you want to, you can bring it down locally as well. So you can just do update help. So I want to just take you on a quick tour, and this was sort of my first impression of actually using Windows Server. And so I'm going to start off with my desktop here. And so first impression, of course, was there is no start menu. So you go, where's the start menu? Well, if you'd worked with a developer's preview, and in fact, with the beta, you would have found that you could actually just go in and make a change in the registry, and you'd be back to the good old start menu. That's gone. You can't do that anymore. And I overheard a conversation with there was a Windows product manager and a couple of guys talking to him and said, well, how do you switch it back? And he says, you don't. You cannot switch it back anymore. And they said, well, we could do it in beta. And they said, he said that was a hack. And I thought, actually, it was just one registry change. In that case, Microsoft had been hacking for years. But there is no start menu, except, actually, there is. It's down there. So if you drop down to the bottom left-hand corner, you have your start menu, and then you discover this little icon over there, and then you think, oh, what do I do with this? Let's see if I can line them up. And you can play for hours, but you probably get into trouble if you're doing that. Now, the whole thing is, do you need a menu? Why does a menu exist? It's so you can find things, isn't it? So if the operating system finds things for you, you don't actually need the menu. So if I'm literally just going to type now. I'm typing power, all right? So I've got Microsoft PowerPoint, I've got PowerShell, I've got settings over here. So there's all my power management settings. So I don't need to bother with a menu and finding things. So for instance, if I type domain in there, what I would do, well, join a domain. And then you get sort of the familiar tools you're used to with joining a domain. You know, you think, well, how on earth do I do update services? Where do I go for that? Remember, just hit the Windows key. Up it comes, and you just type update. That'll do. Oh, no, it's too much. Not enough. Update, and there I've got all my different options for updating. if I go down to my desktop, so I'm just going to go back to the desktop here. Another really nice feature that I really like is I've got a VHD there, okay? I want to have a look at that VHD, so I select it and simply go mount. And now my VHD is available to me, okay? Something that people have been complaining about for years is sort of ISOs. Well, again, no problem there. If I go to over here to my downloads, there's a Windows RC ISO, and I literally just do mount on that, and I have availability to the ISOs as well. So it's things like that that have been, you know, that are now sort of in there in the operating system itself. Now, one of the things is you know, how do you shut this thing down? Because this was one of the first challenges I had was how do I shut it down? Well, you can use if you use the Windows button and C, you end up with the charms, and you can go to settings, and there's your power shutdown. But what I like doing, of course, is remoting all this. And again, what I also like to do is when I'm remoting, I like to keep things like the Alt key down on my local machine. Right? So then you're faced with a challenge. Well, actually, the Windows key doesn't go through to your remote system. So how am I going to deal with that? And of course, everything is actually available. We saw the start menu down here. Right, but if you go over here, you've got the ability of actually bringing up the charms bar. So you can actually get at everything. So next question is, what do I do about administration? Well, I start off in Server Manager, and I've got all my familiar tools available to me. So if I go to my Hyper-V Manager, we can see that I'm actually running at the moment Hyper-V on here. And Hyper-V is much, much faster. The only challenge I've had with Hyper-V is the fact that all my domain controllers came up non-authoritative, but that's easy to script a authoritative restore for Sysvol on one domain controller. Now, if I go across to, I've got a domain controller running over here. I can go to the local server. And what it will do is enumerate all the properties. I can make my changes directly from here. Or I can go all servers, and then I can see all my servers in the environment. And I can just pick up, we've got the events there. We've got services running. I haven't actually enabled Best Practice Analyzer. And there's not time enough to have caught any performance counters. And down there, the roles and features. Want to remote manage one of these guys? No problem. So you just go add roles and features on that remote guy. If I use PowerShell, I can use PowerShell down here as well. So I could do, for instance, an IP config on this guy when it comes up. And that is my edge server that I'm actually looking at and doing an IP config through PowerShell. But of course, I can run PowerShell commands. Now, one of the things you may be if you haven't been following me, the Active Directory track here is there's quite a few features in Active Directory. A lot of them deal with sort of large enterprise scalability things such as management of RID pool, but you've got this ability to clone DCs, you've got safe virtualization of DCs. But there's some nice, interesting things inside here. There's this thing called dynamic access control, which I'll come back to. But if I just go to my corpnet, I've got in here a couple of OUs. I've got A demo, B demo, and sitting in B demo is I've got Peter down there. Over here, I can enable the recycle bin. So I'll just do that. Okay, and do a refresh. And what I should have is deleted objects. So let's actually delete this OU, which has got three users in it. I've turned off object protection, so I'm actually able to delete this without having to change that. So now it's gone, but it's in deleted objects. So what I can do is I can go to Peter, and I can go restore. And what it's saying is the operation can't be performed because the parent's missing. So what I could do is restore to an alternate location, or I can say locate the parent. So we'll restore the parent. And it's telling me again, it can't do it because the parent's missing. So locate parent. So that's demo A. So I had demo A, demo B underneath it. So what we'll do is we'll restore that. We'll restore that. And then we'll restore all of these people in one hit. So you'll see that the recycle bin has become rather more usable. And so we can actually now use that. The other thing I just want to show you briefly is in here, if we go to the system volume. Where's the system volume? Down here. What we've got now is under the password container settings, we can actually now create password settings objects. And this is quite interesting because a lot of what you see in 2012 is about hosting for lots of people. And hosting could be just different business units in your organization, or it could be you're hosting for third parties. But one of the things is becoming very critical if you're hosting for lots of parties, they will want different password policies. So now it's a very easy, simple way of setting them up. So I'm just going to create here a nasty policy. just be, and I think we just set the password length to 200. I also need a precedence in there, so I'm just going to set that. And let's apply that. Who should we apply it against? I think we'll apply it against Mary. So Mary now has a bit of a nasty policy. But equally well, you can go back, and if we find Mary, we can actually see, we can review the resultant password policy for that particular person. And the resultant is based on the precedence of the policy and how it's applied, because you can actually apply a policy to a user or a group. So that's a possibility. And then if you apply two policies to the same user, the precedence is the tiebreaker. Okay, so I've said to you, PowerShell, PowerShell, PowerShell. Well, what have we been doing? We've been using PowerShell. And what you can do is you can simply look at the PowerShell history, you can copy it, and you can paste it. And this is not sort of the definitive way of creating your scripts, of course, but it gives you a very, very good starter if you want to start doing things within the Active Directory. Okay, so having sort of struggled a little bit with working with the GUI to begin with, I actually really, really like the GUI now. And I think there are major advantages. And I've completely gone away from trying to look things up in menu. I've lost that mentality completely, wanting to look in a menu. And I just type in what I need, and before you know it, the thing's found what I'm actually looking for. Okay, so let's go back over here. I've just put this slide in just for reference, just in case you're starting up for the first time. Sometimes it's a little bit tricky finding your way around, so that reference slide is in there. Very, very important thing, it's virtualization, virtualization, virtualization. Not really going to say very much about this, except it's all about virtualization. So do certainly look at what Hyper-V's got to offer, but there's also virtualization of networks. So now what you can do is, if you're going to host for one of your business units and they've got a bunch of servers, physical servers, you can actually take those IP addresses and just use their IPs and bring them in by virtualizing the network. So you may have heard of network virtualization with Azure. It's a similar sort of technology. And also the disk is virtualized now, so we can very easily move disks around. Right? Very, very easy to move Hyper-V machines, replicate Hyper-V machines, migrate them, and so on. Performance, I actually took this slide. It was done at Windows 8 beta time, but it gives you an idea. So now we can have active virtual machines that have gone up to 384 to 1,024. It just gives you the idea of the scale shift. Right? Unfortunately, I've only managed to get 920 on my laptop. But I'm trying. Go. Right, so really what I wanted to do in terms of what my perception is, you look at the operating system, you get a feel for it, and then you start seeing where it meets your needs. And particularly challenging areas. I've done a lot of work with Direct Access. And if you're using Direct Access, you immediately say, well, Direct Access in Windows Server 2008 R2, you don't do it with that, you do it with UAG. All right, so it's very interesting to see what they've done with Direct Access. How many of you got Direct Access? Okay, so that's probably about 40 hands. How many of you thought about Direct Access? Yeah, it's probably double. Okay, so double number thought about it, and then you thought, oh gosh, we've got to have UAG, and then we've got to deal with IPv6 and all the rest of it. So I was really keen to find out 2012 had to offer for that. I do a lot of work in troubleshooting Kerberos. And dealing with now, particularly SharePoint's become very critical in that path, going to back-end systems and wanting to delegate to it. So very keen to see if there are any real Kerberos changes. The other thing I get involved in is authorization. I do a lot of work with identity, particularly in the federation space, but authorization is a real big issue. And when I started to look at 2012, I found that there's very, very significant changes around the authorization space. And the ability to have claims-based authentication. So that was important to me. And then building POCs, I've already proved it to myself, Hyper-V now is absolutely great. The performance you get, I mean, it's like giving machines a new lease of life when you move from, you know, 2008 to Server 2012. when you move there, really performance is enhanced dramatically. So what I decided to do was drill down into direct access, looking at claims-based authentication and the Kerberos changes, and also the new authorization that we can be done through dynamic access control. So first of all, direct access, great idea. Client and the internet just plugs it in, and suddenly it's connected through to CorpNet, and all your worries are over. And the thing is, of course, the user hasn't even logged on, so we're connected through to CorpNet, so now we're in control of that user's machine. All right? And when they log on, they get access to Corp resources. Do a DA demo, all right, to a COE, and they go, wow, you mean I don't even have to connect to the VPN? You know, it's a very impressive technology. Simple, probably not. The reason being is there's a lot of bits and pieces involved. My mouse doesn't work over there. Okay, so first of all, we're going to actually be using different technologies to go from that client, because that client talks over the IPv6 stack, right? Of course, the internet mainly is IPv4. So we've got to transition from that client all the way through to our edge. And the sort of, if you use server 2008 R2, you then had a problem that you had to go from the client transitioning technologies to the edge, and then you had to transition again. So you had to go IPv6 over your IPv4 network. One of the solutions to that was to go UAG, right? So there's that to deal with. And then the transition technologies change depending on where you are. So if you're sitting directly on the internet with an IPv4 public address, you would use a transition technology called 6-to-4. If you were behind a NAT device, so you're on your home network, you'd use a technology called Teredo. And then if Teredo didn't work, the secret weapon was IP-HTTPS. That tunnel is secured by IPsec. So the challenge there was you now had an IPsec tunnel, which you were putting inside an IP-HTTPS tunnel. Right? So you had SSL encryption on top of IPsec encryption. And it didn't give you double the security. It was just an overhead. So IP-HTTPS was seen as the last sort of, if you like, the fallback. And then you had to deal with encryption, PKI was required, and then you needed to worry about how the client located the fact it was inside the CorpNet or outside. So this DA idea that you just connected the client on the internet, it was connected through to CorpNet, had a lot of challenges. So, come on, mouse. I think I have a broken mouse. Okay, so additional challenges, UAG. UAG was really, if you were serious about direct access, you needed to go UAG. Because, again, 2008 R2 would offer you no capability of building a fault-tolerant array to come into. So we couldn't bring in support load balancing. Also, we needed UAG to allow us to do a translation so we come in over the transition technologies, IPv6 from the client, over IPv4 to the edge, but then we had to go into another transition technology. UAG allowed you to split it out using NAT64 and also DNS64. Windows Server 2012 fixes load balancing. You can do it out the box. It has support for NAT64 and DNS64 in it. What NAT64 and DNS64 do, they work together. IPv6 client out there, and what it wants to do is talk to an IPv4 over there. But it needs to talk IPv6 to it. So what happens is it makes a DNS request. This guy, the DNS 64, goes over to DNS inside. It's, it's IPv4. So what I'll do is I will spoof you an IPv6 address. And what that spoofed IPv6 address will do is bring you back to NAT64. So now the client gets its IPv6 address back, ends up at the NAT64, and the NAT64 takes the IPv6 payload and puts it into IPv4. Goes across, comes back to NAT64, goes back to the client, and everything's working. Those are now built in. The next thing is requires two consecutive IPv4 addresses. You don't need that anymore. You can put it behind a NAT device, okay? Because that was actually a bit of a pushback from a lot of people. You needed two IPv4s. Domain, multi-domain support was complex. That has now been simplified, so support for multiple domains. Multi-site was a complete... I better not use the terminology I was going to use. It's probably... It was complete something. All right, that has now been supported. And if you're using Windows 8 clients, they will automatically fail over between sites if a site becomes unavailable. So now we can come in, multi-site environment. So if you're sitting in Paris, you automatically connect to the Paris hub. If you're sitting in New York, you automatically connect to the New York hub. But if the New York hub failed, a Windows 8 client will automatically fail over and come in through Paris. Monitoring, troubleshooting really didn't exist very well. That's now very, very comprehensive. RAS and DA couldn't exist. So now you have an edge device, and you either have DA on it or you have RAS, but you can't have both. Again, that's supported. 2FA was really only available if you used smart cards. There was no OTP support. That's now fixed. And many deployments didn't get off the drawing board. I would be asked in, I would consult with a lot of companies, we'd go through it all, and they go, I don't think we're ready for IPv6. You know, and the project really just halted at that point. So again, I think DA is showing a new lease of life. The other thing you had two tunnels. You had two tunnels coming in, and the first tunnel, this is an IPsec tunnel. You come from the client, you'd hit the end tunnel endpoint. So you haven't got into your corporate network yet, right? So at the tunnel endpoint, you needed to authenticate. And you would authenticate using a certificate from the client, right, and the client identity. So this is the machine coming in, right? But to authenticate the actual client itself, this guy at the tunnel endpoint needed to do NTLM. Right, it would have to go to the domain controller on your behalf. That's been fixed. There is now a Kerberos proxy that sits at the tunnel endpoint. Right, so now we can come in Kerberos all the way through. We can also get rid of the need for two tunnels as well. So if we're using Windows 8 clients, we can come in through a single tunnel configuration, and IP HTTPS has been optimized. So you can do SSL null. I wouldn't advise it for going to your websites and things like that, because SSL null doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you've got an IPsec secure encrypted tunnel inside SSL, SSL null makes a lot of sense in terms of performance. So that's solved. And then what you've got is you've got no need for NAT. It will support NAT behind the single tunnel. It's using IP HTTPS. No need for PKI. So we don't have to worry about PKI. And if you've got no public SSL cert, it will automatically create the cert for you. Obviously not a public one, but the clients obviously know about the certificate. And we can deploy group policy through WMI filters as well against the clients. If you want full feature direct access, you can obviously still do it. However, there's this three-click wizard which will take you through and get you started. And so getting started, you can start. And of course, the three-click wizard only supports Windows 8 clients. So let's actually go through this process. Let's start off and look at my environment here. And what I've got here is a number of different things. So I have what I call my ISP, and this is my internet service provider is providing me DNS actually on the out on the internet. I've then also got an edge server, and the edge server has two network cards in it, one facing out onto my virtual internet and one facing internal onto my corporate network. I then have my pretty Windows 8 enterprise client, and then I have over here my domain controller, and I also have an application server. So if we start away on the Windows 8 client, I'm inside CorpNet at the moment. I have an application server running IIS 8. I've got a share where I've got some UK sales data, and I've actually got some US sales data. And we'll need to secure that properly shortly. But let's go start off on the edge. Okay. So first of all, you install it as a role, and then you go to remote access management. So this is how we actually configure this guy. And once it's cranked up, what we'll be able to do is do a very, very quick install of Direct Access. And there we go. That was a nervous moment. Run the getting started wizard. Okay, so deploy Direct Access only. It's checking my prereqs. And now it's saying it's detected it as an edge device. The reason being, I've got a public internet address on one network card, and I've got my CorpNet. If I had two private addresses on it, it would say it's behind an edge device with a single network adapter if I had them both on one network adapter, or it would say it's behind an edge device with two network adapters. It would have worked that out. So what I need is the location that my DA clients are going to go to. So daexample.com is where my DA clients will connect. And I click Finish. So it's just going through, it's creating all the policies. And in fact, it's pretty much, if you're familiar with Direct Access already, it's still creating GPOs and all the rest of it. But that's done. Okay, so, and there is the familiar remote access setup. So is that quicker than doing DA normally for those people who've done it before? Just a little bit. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll now just go over to my domain controller, and we'll go to the group policy on my domain controller. There's a couple of little hiccups at the moment. There's one hiccup and one thing I can't support. So what it's done is it's actually created me a Direct Access client settings. And one of the things that it's not doing at the moment is turning off 6-4. So at the moment, it would prefer a 6-4 access rather than actually switching to IP HTTPS. The reason being is that I've actually, my pretend internet has a public address on it, and my client's sitting on a public address. And what at the moment it is doing is if I tested it now, it would fail because it's using a 6-4 rather than starting up its tunnel. So I'm assuming this will... this is an RC issue. I'm just going to go into my going to drill down in here and actually set to 6-4 to disabled. So we'll need to go into the actually administrative templates. So it's network, and we're down under network to TCP/IP settings. And we're looking at IP6 transition technologies. And there's the HTTPS, the Teredo, ISOTAP, and 6-4. So what I'm doing is I'm just turning my 6-4 state to disabled. So I'm enabling the group policy and disabling the state. The other thing I have to do is you are saying the client actually gets its group policy through WMI. I cannot set my virtual environment to produce the correct WMI filter result. So what I'm going to do, it's against all domain computers, and I'm going to just remove that for the moment. And I've got a group with just my DA clients in it. So I'm going to add that group, do a check name on there, and then I'm going to take the filter out. So at the moment, there's no way. I mean, if anyone knows how I can simulate a PC Type 2 in a Hyper-V environment, I would love to know. I couldn't find a way of doing it. So I'm actually removing the WMI filter. So we'll just remove the link for that. Okay, so group policy for the client is correct. If and I'm going to just confirm that. Yeah, so DA clients, and there is no WMI filter anymore. Okay, so I can go and apply that. By the way, this would have been automatically applied had I let the wizard do it, and it could cope with the current settings. So I'm just going to do a GP update on my client. So we'll do that. And then just check that that successfully gets applied. So computer policy, that's good. So next job is the user policy. Actually, what we'll do now is I'm going to move my client. And this is the simplest way of doing it, because I don't actually have DHCP from my ISP. So I've disabled my CORP interface, and I'm enabling my my virtual internet. So I've actually got two network cards on this client. One is on the corporate network. One is on the virtual internet. So now this guy is connected to the virtual internet. And what I'm going to do is actually just go back to the edge. And let's have a look at the dashboard on the edge. I've deliberately done it this way because there's just timing for it all to happen. Oh, we've got green eyes, but we've also got blue eyes. So let's just do a refresh. Yep, everything's nice and green. And if we look at operational status, it says it's working properly, which is great. So if we go back to the client machine, what we should find is actually this guy is connected through to CorpNet. So it's showing I'm connected through to the workplace, which is good. And then I'm just going in on app one, so no problems there. And I'm going in on sales. And again, no problems there. So I've now come in from the internet, and I've gained access to my CorpNet and also my sales. So if we do our IP config on here, what I can see is my HTTP tunnel is up. Okay, and if you're horrified by those, they're just the friendly IPv6 addresses that the client's using, but it's tunneling it through the IP HTTPS tunnel. So that's looking good, and I'm coming in through there. And the other thing you can do is you can actually, what we can do here is look at the firewall settings. And what I'm doing to get there, what I'm going to do is go to my start menu, and then I'm just going to type in fire. And I've got settings up here. And what I'm looking for is Windows firewall. And if we look down here, under the advanced settings, what we can see is the IPsec rules, so this connection security rules. So these have been deployed via group policy. And there's a simplified rule there. This is done by the wizard. And if we look at authentication, normally you would expect to see certificates in NTLM. Here it's computer Kerberos and it's user Kerberos. The reason it can do that is because of the little Kerberos proxy that sits at the end of the tunnel. And if we look down under the security associations, so these are the IPsec security associations, you can actually see that we've actually connected through. And we can see the whole thing is using Kerberos at this point for both the user and the computer authentication. So as I say, very, very significant changes there, and simplification of DA. So if you looked at DA before and you thought DA was attractive, and as I say, it was about out of the overall group, there were probably maybe 100 people odd who'd looked at it, and then 50 of those had dismissed it. Actually, I think it was a bigger figure than 100 that had looked and dismissed it. Revisit it now with 2012. One caveat on this is that at the moment, the release candidate for Windows 8 client is professional, and it won't do DA. However, if you want to test out DA, you can use the server. It will do DA. But if you're testing it from an IPv4 public address, you will need to do what I did and actually turn off the 6-to-4. Otherwise, the IP HTTPS tunnel will never come up. So if you're evaluating it at this stage, or if you've got an agreement with Microsoft, you can get hold of an enterprise copy of Windows 8, and that will work. Okay, so we've already seen one Kerberos enhancement, which is the proxy. Unfortunately, the proxy is not something you can say, hey, wow, I can put my proxy everywhere. The proxy has specifically been designed to support direct access, so it's not a service that we can use elsewhere at the moment. So what we've got is, in terms of Kerberos general enhancements, the SSPI context buffer size being increased, the pack, which is where all of your groups are stored, has now got compression on it. All right. So how many of you suffered from Kerberos token bloat? Yeah, quite a lot. So you blow up your Kerberos token, and then you have to fiddle it and increase the ability to hold and make the token larger, make changes to that. Well, now we've got compression. We've also got warnings when you've got that you're coming up to pushing your Kerberos token limit. There's also increased logging on Kerberos all round, so it's a good sign there. Claim support and delegation. That's a very important area, and they've made a significant change there. So number one, if we look at a pre-2012 Kerberos token, the pack, Kerberos token itself identified the user, the pack contained all of your group membership. So if you had thousands of groups, that pack got very big, which is why your token blew up. Now what you can do is you can have inside the pack user and device claims. When we talk about compound identity, we're talking about user and device claims together. The user claims and the device claims, the compound identity will support groups. So let's just stick with that for the moment. So compound, we've got user groups, and we've got device groups. If you want to, you can enable claims. And what is a claim? A claim is an Active Directory attribute value, or attribute type and value, to be precise, that we allow to be passed inside the Kerberos token. All right? So if you have a department value, you could have that put in the token. You could now make authorization decisions based on the department that user is in. Right? And suddenly, you can change your group model dramatically. And I will come back on that. The other thing is that to get this working, what we need to do is we need to turn on CBAC for Kerberos. It's also referred to as FAST, which is your flexible authentication secure tunneling, right? FAST has a number of other benefits. One of the weaknesses of Kerberos is that during the pre-authentication sequence, when the user is logging on, it is possible to, if you're using weak passwords, to crack that and then do an offline dictionary attack to find the user's password. What FAST does is it armors that initial exchange. So now you can't do offline dictionary attacks. The other clever Kerberos trick was to actually get a client and send back bogus Kerberos error messages. So the client says, oh, I can't do Kerberos. I better do use NTLM. So it would weaken the security posture because then you can attack it using so you can use the tools for attacking NTLM. All of the Kerberos error messages are now signed. So that's for preventing spoofing. And as we said before, we've got compound identity capability. Delegation. How many of you have done either constrained or unconstrained delegation? So that's, yeah, probably, I don't know, probably about 80 people, something like that. Okay, so the big problem with delegation, so that just if you haven't done delegation, you know what delegation is, quick summary, you've got a front-end service, right? We come into the front-end service with a user identity, and what that front-end service wants to do is it wants to go to a back-end service with that user identity. So we can audit on the back-end service based on the user identity. All right. So the challenge has been is that front end service and the back end service, if we're using constrained delegation, has had to be in the same domain. All right. They've completely broken that now. So you can have a front end service, which is in one domain, talking to a service in another domain, talking to a service in a trusted domain. So across in a different forest. So we've got that capability of supporting it. The other challenge has been is all of this delegation bit has been done in the Active Directory. So if we want to set this up, we've got a front-end service, and then we've got a back-end service. Right? The configuration to allow those guys to get access here has been configured in AD. So the poor application owner has had no protection. Right? You can't actually constrain the delegation on the service itself. So now you have the ability, you've got this thing called principles allowed to delegate to account. So on the server itself, with PowerShell, what we can do is we can say who we're going to allow in as security principles. So now we've got control at that level. You've still got the similar sort of thing as you previously got in the Active Directory to set it up, but now we've got control at application level. If you don't want it to go across a trust, we can actually disable it across a trust as well. So if you've got SID filtering across trust, so this just gives you an extra bit of protection across a trust. So you've got that capability. So what I want to do is I want to enable claims identity. So I'm going to actually enable claims identity so I can start using claims when it comes to authorization. So I'm going to start off by doing a bit of a cleanup. Let's get rid of some of this junk. And first of all, let's put this guy back on CorpNet. So we'll take him off the internet, put him back on CorpNet. And the next job I want to do is actually close that off, and then we'll close that. And, let me just have a look. So, hang on a minute. Let me just, hold on a second. I'm not sure I've not got a problem here. Won't be a second. No, it's come to life again. That's okay. All right, so, and having cleaned up the junk, what we'll do is we'll go across to our Active Directory and on my Active Directory, I need to go into Tools, into Administrative Center. And you remember the access control the dynamic access control that I pointed to as a node. We're going to be working in this node. So, claim type. All right, I decide which claims I would like to add to a Kerberos token. So, I choose a claim type. And what I'm going to do is just enumerated the schema, telling me what I can use. I'm going to use department. So department in there. And what I'd like to use it for is compound identity. So user department and computer department. So if this is going to be compound. And I'm going to suggest some values that can go in here. So I'm going to add in here. And we'll see why I suggest the values later. So we're going to have UK sales. So UK sales in there. And actually, we better just make that a capital K. Otherwise, they won't let me back in the country. So capital K in there. So UK sales. We better have US sales in here. So these are my departments. And next down there. And finally, what we'll do is we'll use in here corporate sales. So these are suggested values for these particular attributes. And I say you'll see why we've got suggested values in a moment. So that's taken care of that. I want to use one other attribute. So I'm going to go in here. I'm going to go new claim type. And I'm going to, in here, I want job title. So we use title in here. So you're just going to change the description name to job title. And not many computers have a job title, so I'm going to leave that blank. So it's just going to be user identity, and I need to put some suggested values in. Again, you will see why later on. So we got consultant, and actually this is a sales consultant, but they're just called consultant. And I'm going to also add in here, so I'm going to have a sales manager. Okay. So that's okay. So that's done. Right. So let's have a look at just one of my users, just to so I've got in here a user, John, and if we look at that user, John, what we'll see is that he's got a job title of consultant, and he's in the UK sales. So that's fine, and we don't need to look any more on that. I don't need to make any changes. So let's see if it's working, I guess, is the next thing, is we actually need to see if this we are actually getting these claims. So I'm over here. I'm just going to log the user off to get a new security token. So I'm actually going to sign out, and I'm going to sign in again. So we'll come in here as Maria. And Maria is a US sales consultant. So, and luckily we've got PowerShell set up on the desktop for all our users. And I'm not doing any PowerShell, but I'm just using Who Am I. Now, Who Am I has been extended to have claims. And what we can see is actually her job title is consultant, and her department is US sales. Notice this thing, Kerberos support for dynamic access control, this device has been disabled. We'll have to fix that in a second. But let's actually have a look. You remember, we've got this other guy, and we better have a look and sign him in just to make sure that that's set up correctly. So we just come across here, and we've got Tom, and Tom, if you remember, is a sales manager. And again, we just drop down and look at his claims. So Who Am I claims on here. And what we see is, yes, he's a sales manager, and his department is corp sales. So that's great. And we've nearly done, except I just want to show you how this was set up in group policy. There's two bits of group policy involved here. Number one, we need group policy against the domain controllers, because I've actually already enabled CBAC. The reason being, it takes time to propagate through. And I've come to my administrative templates, Windows components, and system rather. And what we're looking for is KDC. So we got KDC, and this is KDC support for claims, compound authentication, and Kerberos armoring, or if you like, fast. And what I've done is I've enabled it. You don't have to have all 2012 or 2012 servers, but you need enough of them to support your client community set. Next thing is I go down to my direct access clients, because this is the client that I'm accessing. So I've got a group policy across my direct access clients. So I'm just using that one to be lazy. And this time, what I'm looking for down here is Kerberos rather than KDC. And what I've got here is, at the moment, compound identity is not enabled. So I'm going to enable compound identity. And what we can do here is just apply that. And then what we'll have to do is refresh the policy on my Windows 8 box. So here we go. Let's do a GP update on this. Actually, what I'm going to do is just run that as administrator to make sure I don't have any problems. So we just do a GP update. And that's forced through the updates. And what we should find is, if we look at those claims again, it's no longer telling us that device claims are not supported. So computer policy done, user policy done. That all looks good. And let's just do this again. So we're just going to... Okay, so now what we've got is we've got the dynamic access control all set up. And so we've now got dynamic access control for claim set up. But next question is, how do you use it? So if we look at how we might use it. Let's take a scenario. You have sales consultants, right? And they are regional sales consultants, and they must only be able to access their regional sales documents. Okay, so that's rule number one. You've then got sales managers that must have access to sales documents in all regions. Rule two. And then you've got sales documents with a high business impact must only be viewable by sales managers. All right? And then you've got the access model must be applied across multiple file servers in the Active Directory forest. So that becomes a bit of a challenge. So you start thinking about using domain local groups. So it's going around your head. And how am I going to deal with this high impact business documents? I'm obviously going to have a different folder for that and apply a different permission set. And if you read that, it says forest. All right, so my domain local groups aren't going to work. So I'm going to have to repeat this and do it in everything. So you start scripting it all, and it's a bit painful. And then you say high-impact documents should only be accessible from client machines that are managed by the corporate sales department. And you go, how am I going to do that one? And you might think, what we need is IPsec and need to deploy that. Well, now, my mention of compound identity, maybe you're starting to think we could do it with compound identity. So how many different designs can you come up with? And the answer is lots and lots. All right. The trouble is, and the challenge will be, is how do we guarantee high impact documents are placed in the correct folder? And the answer is with a lot of difficulty. So we've just suddenly pushed up our group community, and that Kerberos token's got a little bit bigger. So what we need is a solution to get around all this. So our challenge is there's no way to tag files, right, and apply authorization auditing based on file type. Now we can do that. So we can actually tag files and base our permissions on that tagging. So we've got a high-impact document. We can have it in the same folder as a low-impact document and have two permission sets. No way to create ACLs based on expressions. We can do that. If document is a sales resource and a user is UK sales and a user has access to high-impact documents and they're working from a particular device, so we can achieve that. ACLs defined using groups. Well, what have you got in your Kerberos token now? You've got claims. And claims just to, because sometimes people think, what's a claim? All right, claim is simply an attribute that you declare, and that value of that attribute goes inside, and that's your claim. Now you can make decisions based on claims, user claims and device claims, and user groups and device groups if you want to. And then device state not supported in authorization decisions, compound ID, we've got it. So we've got a completely different access authorization model now. So here's the answer. Don't need a complex file structure. Push them all in, all right? We'll still split out our regional UK and US sales. Don't absolutely have to. We could just bundle them in all together. This is just to make it a little bit neater. But we can have high-impact documents in that UK folder, and only the appropriate people can get it. Do we need any groups? Don't need them. Question at the front.
In a transition period, what is that going to do to the token size?
In the transition period, what is it going to do to the token size was the question. It's more difficult to blow your token size up. You've also got a pack compression as well, right? So in that transition period, obviously, we've got to have enough 2012 servers deployed to be able to support the transition. But during that time, if you've got if you've already blown your token up completely, then you obviously have to be sensitive to that. But in fact, I mean, the design transition best practice on that, to be honest, I haven't done the evaluation on that at the moment. I was hoping Microsoft would first, and then I'd read the white paper. But it might well be something. It's certainly something we're bearing in mind and we're starting to look at. In 6 months' time, I'll probably have an answer for you. I just lost my microphone box off the back of me. Okay. So let's actually implement this. So we even solve the nice to have in this. So what I want to do is just implement this solution, and I'm going to show you how we can actually achieve this. So there's my Windows 8 client, and what I want to do is go over to my domain controller. And in fact, actually, we won't start on the domain controller. What we'll start on is we'll start going over, I think, and actually work on the application server. So into my E drive, where I've got my sales folder. You remember we saw this folder actually from the client machine. And I'm going to start off at sales. And what I've got is I've got classification. We'll see how we get classification in a moment. So country, department, impact. And I'm going to set the country to both UK and US. Reason being, it's top-level folder. So UK people will be able to gain access and US people, right? So department, this is for the sales department. So what I'm going to do is actually set it up so the department here is going to be sales. So I've got a great list I can choose from. And I'm going to classify the impact as here as low. So everything is going to be classified as low impact. I'm then going to drop down below this, and I'm going to go to UK sales. And I'm going to change the classification on UK sales. And I'm going to actually make that so it's just UK sales rather than being UK and US. And I will do exactly the same down here on US. So on the classification there. Right. So that's done. So that's completed the classification. You may be wondering, where did the classification come from? Well, let's just see if it's propagated first. So you're looking at US takeover and classification on there, country US, department sales, impact low. So that's correct. All right, so what we better see is how we got this thing in the first place. And to do that, what we're going to do have to do is actually look at our Active Directory configuration. And here, we're looking again into, let's just close that up. We're looking down into here, into the resource properties. These are the resource properties already predefined. So I've got company, compliancy, confidentiality, and what you'll see is they have values in them. And I can deploy this classification centrally across my file servers. So if I actually look at that, I choose the ones I want by creating a resource property list. So if I look under sales classification, what I've chosen is department and impact, but I also chose country. Country didn't exist, so I created my own. All right, so I created my own country property. And I've actually bundled those together, and I simply deploy this against my file servers and using, obviously, group policy to achieve that. So if we drill down in here, and what we need to do is go down to my sales server group policy. So again, to edit that, and I need to drill down under my administrative settings, and I'm looking for system, and I'm looking for file classification infrastructure. So that's what got it deployed. Okay, so that's now deployed against my file servers, and then I can actually do the classification on the file servers themselves. So, as I say, this is actually now allows me to classify all my different servers within my environment. Next job, I need some central access rules. So what I'll do in here is go new central access rule. And here what I'm doing is I'm actually, we'll call it in here, sales access. And what am I going to apply against? I am going to apply this against a resource where the department, right, is so actually matches equals sales. So this rule I'm about to create will only apply against sales resources. And that's folders, files that have been classified as sales resources. Next job is, do I want to do these as proposed permissions, which I can do, and then I can audit, or do I want to do them as current permissions, in which case they will be set? I'm going to do current so we can see the result immediately. I then go add an authenticated user, okay? So I'm now saying authenticated users have modify access provided the resource, and we'll start with country, is in here, is UK sales, add a condition, and here the resource, again, we'll do, in fact, we'll change, we'll make sure we use resource here, is impact, and I'll say any of this time, low or moderate, okay? And then finally, what we do is we add a condition, and we say here, rather than using group, I could use group still, so I can mix this up with groups. I'm saying the users department is UK sales. So that looks right. So you've authenticated users have access, provided the resource is UK sales, the impact is low or moderate, and the user is from the UK sales department. Not a single group in sight. Okay, next job is we will add again, and I just want to show this for completeness. I'm going to add in here authenticated user again, modify, and this time we're going to do it for our US resource. So we choose US in here, and we'll go add a condition. And we're looking again, resource impact is going to be low or moderate, and then add a condition and department equals US sales. And then, so that one's done. Just check it. That's correct. That one's correct. And US sales. Okay. And then I'm going to add a final one in here. And I'm going to say this time, again, authenticated user. And I'm going to do a check name on that. And then I'm going to give full control this time. Add a condition. And what I'm saying this time is the user job title equals sales manager and the device department. And you can see why I actually, using this, you can see why I actually put suggested values in here. Okay? So it makes this, using this interface, a lot easier. That's done. The next job I have to do is I can have lots of these different central access rules, but I can bundle them up together. And so that's okay. So I can now go to central access policies up here. And what I do is I create a new central access policy. And in my central access policy, what I'm going to do is just give it a name of something. And what better than name than policy? And there is. I'm going to deploy this rule set in that central access policy. As I say, you can bundle lots of these up together to give you really, well, complex rule sets. I'm going to deploy this against my sales servers. So here, what we do is we go to policies, and this is actually a security setting. So we go into Windows settings, and what we're looking for under here is under security settings, we're looking for file system, central access policy, and manage central access policy, and add that in. Okay, so all that's left to do is to push this against, actually push this against my app server, or pull it rather. So what we need to do is just do a GP update on here. So that's done, or it will be done in a moment. And then what we can do is we can actually test out that it's all working. And there's a very nice way of doing that, which we'll see in a second or two. That's it. Okay. So now what we can do is we can actually go down and look at our E drive and look at the properties on that, the security advanced. And we can go to central policy, and currently it's showing no access policy. We can change that, and we can choose our sales policy. And if we look under sales access, you can see it's slightly cryptic, but it's not bad, actually. So if we look at that first one, resource.country, any of sales, resource.impact, any of moderate or low, and user department equals US sales. So it's reasonably readable. And Well, okay that. Well, actually, we'll apply that rather than okay it. And then what we can do is we can go down to one of our documents. So I'm going to go to UK takeovers. And what we'll do is we'll see if we can access it. So here, we've actually got a very good effective permissions on here. So under the advanced settings, we go to effective permissions, and we'll test it out. And we'll test it out with one of our users. Now, John is a Sales UK consultant. Let's see if he has access. Yes, he's actually got access. Full control is being blocked by sales access policy and also file permissions. This is multi-layered. File permissions can also override, but we can see we've got green flashes. So he's got modify. Let's take that up a bit bigger, actually. So we've got modify access in there. Let's try another user in here, and we're using Maria. And Maria is actually a US salesperson. And let's test that. She's blocked, which is exactly as it should be, because she should only be able to gain access to US documents. So, and you see it's blocked there by the sales access policy. Let's change the classification on this document, and I'm going to make it high impact. Okay, so we'll change from low impact and make it high. And then we'll test John again. So in terms of security, we need to go to advanced settings again, and we're going to effect permissions. Now, John, if you remember, this is a sales document, check name, view effective, and he's blocked. Okay, which is exactly what we want with a high impact document. But Tom is a sales manager, so we've added him. Let's view the effective permission, and Tom, oh, he's blocked. But what did we say also? The device he's on needs to be managed by the corporate sales department. So let's put him on a device that is managed by Corp Sales. So we'll go to our client here, and it's my Windows 8 E client. And let's view effective. And there he is. So you're fully protected by the device as well now in terms of authorization. So I think you can see that's a fairly significant change that we've now got. And I don't expect you to deploy it tomorrow, but what I wanted you to start thinking about it. Also, be aware that if you're going to use attributes as claims, they now become security sensitive. So if you've got a delegation model in the Active Directory, that will you'll have to take that into account, that can somebody change their own attribute that you now want to use as a claim. If you haven't got a delegation model for administration in the AD, and you're thinking about it, now factor this in. The other thing, actually, I absolutely couldn't miss out on. I have to show you this. It's going to be a 30-second demo. I actually have to show you this because this is something here. I've got, if I look at my file system and what I want, actually, let's, oh, we'll start on the, we'll go up here. This is my E drive where I actually happen to run all my Hyper-V machines. And let's just select this. 179 gigs of Hyper-V machine. Space on disk, 5 gigs. It's using disk dedupe, all right? Lots and lots of Hyper-V machines there, but by using disk dedupe, it actually chops it up into blocks. And there's nothing more scary than the current file system. Current file system holds all your data in blocks, just links it all up. Well, this disk dedupe now just has a look for blocks that are the same. And if you're running lots of Hyper-V machines, you no longer even have to think about using parent disks. If you've done Hyper-V with parent disks and try to get all crammed on your laptop, forget it. Just give everyone a full disk and switch on disk deduplication. By the way, be careful, the UI, I think, was written by a marketing guy, because sometimes it comes up with only 2 megs consumed. And that is definitely wrong. But it does get about a 73% increase. Let me just go back over here. Okay, so that's what's hot for me right at this moment. That's what I've been working on for the last few years in terms of sort of supporting people with DA, et cetera. But the whole product is very hot. There's lots of exciting things to use in it. So I suggest what you do is you really just get started with it, start looking at it, and then focus on significant technology for you. There's a plug for me if you want it. Question is, you need to ask yourself, what is hot for you? What do you need to be looking at? And just a final reminder is, please spend some time to fill out the evaluations. They're very, very important to us. And have a great lunch and enjoy the rest of TechEd.